Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Live Your Raw Life podcast. Welcome to the platform where the intention is to help you live your rich, authentically aligned, wholesome life. I'm your host, Rachel Ann Watkins. Together, let's raise our vibrations and awareness in order for you to live the raw life that was meant for you.
After you get a little bit of yoga in you, there's kind of a breakdown that happens. And it literally is a seeing for the first time of like, I have been operating on a faulty manual. Mm-hmm. I have been operating on a pattern that is harmful and limiting, and I need to let go of the very things that I've been using as crutches.
That is Karen Carlson. Karen is a yoga teacher, but not your average yoga instructor. She describes herself as a rebel yogi teaching a deeper practice. She teaches yoga to truly honor the traditions and sacredness. That is the practice. In today's show, we take the conversation from how yoga came into Karen's life to the social expectations of yoga in the fitness industry to the importance of white women talking to other white women about their racism, and finally, how you can connect and work with Karen in the various avenues that she offers. Given where humanity is right now, it felt like the timing of this conversation is well placed. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy the show.
Today's guest is someone so special to me, an important teacher in my life. She has taught me so many things about life through yoga. Prior to meeting her, I'd practiced yoga, but it was quote unquote gym yoga, which to me now feels as though the sacredness of the practice is lost. My husband came home one day and told me that someone was opening an actual yoga studio in town. This was when I lived in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I was beyond excited. When the doors finally opened, I went to my first return yoga class, and that was it. I was hooked. Karen pushed me past my comfort zone with various poses, but through the discomfort, she made me feel safe, held, and supported. She encouraged me to push myself, and that is where I finally felt my growth and deep healing begin. She started every class with a message, which she weaved through the entire class, and it was literally 100% exactly what I needed to hear every damn time. I told Isaac on many occasions, it feels like she followed me around today and knew just what I needed to hear. It was amazing. When I moved to Colorado, I was comparing every studio and every teacher to her. She simply could not be replaced. So I decided I needed to bring her knowledge to my practice, or at least as best I could. So I decided to go through yoga teacher training with her. In the summer of 2016, my boys and I flew to Minnesota for 5 weeks, and I went through her 200-hour teacher training. It was magical. It deepened my knowledge, but also deepened my love for the sacred practice that is yoga. I'm honored to be able to offer a space for this wise, beautiful soul. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you.
You have such a way of drawing connections between the duality of things, especially when it comes to yoga, the fitness industry, society, and life in general. Your ability to shine light on the dark places and have the hard conversations are admirable. You have been such a powerful teacher for me in this lifetime, and I know our listeners will learn from you as well. With that, to get us started, would you mind to share a little bit about how yoga came into your life?
Sure. I think I have lots of the first time I did yoga stories because I think a lot of people do. I think it's kind of on the fringes for a long time until it really lands, until kind of you're ready for it. And that was certainly true for me as well. Although I think when I really latched onto it or fell into it, I still wasn't ready. I didn't know what was coming. I didn't know what it was going to do to my entire life. The short story is that a girlfriend dragged me. And that is usually people's stories too, right? Is that a girlfriend made you go. I had a girlfriend who I, at the time, was an out-of-control alcoholic. And I was a binge drinker, so I would drink for days on end until I passed out and would wake up sometimes in hospitals, sometimes in jail cells, sometimes in detoxes, and sometimes just on the street. But sometimes I woke up in her apartment, and this was one of those days where I woke up in her apartment because I couldn't walk home, so I must have walked into her apartment and spent the night there. And she was fed up with it. She was fed up with me. She had tried all the good girlfriend things. She tried to kind of cut me off. She tried to yell at me. She tried to hold my hand. She had encouraged me to go to counseling. She had been to the hospital with me. She had talked to me about all the things. She had gone through all the things. And that morning, she was so angry that she woke me up by stomping around her apartment, like on purpose, clanging things, knowing that I was going to wake up with a terrible hangover. But she was pissed. She eventually woke me up and said, you're going to yoga with me. You need to learn how to take care of yourself. You're going to yoga with me. And I lit a cigarette and asked her for coffee. And she was like, oh no, we're going to a hot yoga studio. You can't drink coffee and you shouldn't be smoking cigarettes. And she was just angry at me. So we were just having this little cat fight. And she eventually convinced me that I needed to go with her. And she lent me a sports bra and some shorts and some flip flops because I was just in my, you know, street clothes. And she literally dragged me down the block to go into this place. I turned my underwear inside out so that it'd be somewhat fresh. I threw up in the alleyway on my way there. And I went and I hated it. But there were moments in hating it where, oddly, I was like, I can do this one. I could just, there were moments where I was like, I can do that one. And I saw myself thinking, as in I could see how judgy I was being of everybody else in the room and like, oh, these stupid fitness people. And then like, I was just being so judged and I could see it. And then I could kind of see how self-loathing I was being at the same, it was like there was a bubble cloud over my head of this is what my brain is saying as I'm going through this class. And that was, you know, people can be aware of their thoughts and I had been aware of my thoughts, but not in that way. There was something unique to it. And there was as most yoga studios do, there was some kind of intro special. So my girlfriend bought me the intro special. And I went back, not the next day, because I went back out and went drinking again, but within a week or so, I did go back. And that second time, I remember waking up in the middle of the night after yoga class and just feeling like I had a different body. Mm. Like it was my body, but it didn't feel like my, like it was so tactilely, viscerally different. And I knew that I was going to go back to yoga. And I did. And then, you know, then I was a work study. And then through getting into yoga, it is really hard to go to yoga every day and maintain a binge drinking lifestyle. They just don't go together very well. And again, like I knew I was an alcoholic. I come from a family of alcoholics. I had tried to get sober in all sorts of ways and nothing had worked. But there was something in the yoga practice that made me open-minded enough or gave me enough kind of a margin of safety in that understanding, like I don't have to do it perfect, I just have to do my best, that made me realize like, okay, I need to try to get sober. And I knew that I needed to go to AA. I knew that that's what you do. So I did. And I didn't like AA either because I don't like most things. I'm like, I hate most things, especially if they're group activities. I don't like group activities. And, you know, AA tends to be a lot of men and a lot of talk about God. And so that too made me very uncomfortable. But the yoga, and it was a very secular kind of yoga. It was Bikram. So they don't talk a lot of spirituality, but there was enough. There was just enough that the teachers would slide in about, you know, again, doing what you can and letting go of the rest and starting to realize that there's something bigger than you. And so they were just giving me these little things, and I knew they were true because they were true in my body in yoga. Mm-hmm. So I got those little things, and those little things made me tolerant enough that I could stay in an AA meeting. And then again, like I ran away and went drinking again, but within a couple days I was back, and then I went the next day, and then I went the next day, and eventually I got sober. Mm. And then I went to teacher training because I was in getting sober. There was this whole, my life is a mess and I need to let go of trying to control it and trying to control my drinking. I can't control my drinking. I need to just do whatever the AA people and the yoga people are encouraging me to do. So I ended up calling my dad at one point, who is a recovering alcoholic, and I hadn't talked to him in years. I hadn't talked to my family. I had dissociated myself from my family out of shame, mostly. So I called my dad and I said, I'm an alcoholic and I'm trying to get right. And he was like, no shit, because they've known that since I was 15 years old. It wasn't a surprise to him, but it was a surprise to hear that I was trying.
How old were you at that time, Karen?
29.
Okay.
And he offered to come get me. He said, and I was just kind of like, I don't know what's happening in my life. I don't know. Like just very lost, very, everything was falling apart. And he said, do you want to come home? So he flew out. We rented a U-Haul, and it was a little U-Haul, so I had to leave most of my stuff behind. But we drove home to Minnesota. Again, I hadn't seen most of them in a long time. And again, there was a lot of shame in coming home and a lot of grief in leaving New York and feeling like a failure because New York had always been where I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And my sister was pregnant with her first baby, and there was a lot of grief personally around that. And it was a mess. It was a big fucking painful mess. But for a year, I did nothing but go to yoga teacher training, practice yoga, and go to AA meetings. And that's what I did. I lived on my sister's couch and I just did that stuff. And after teacher training, someone asked me to teach, and I did, and I have not done anything else since. Hmm.
Amazing. So yeah. Yoga, it saved you.
Absolutely saved me, sort of. Like, yes, I want it. Absolutely. Yoga did something that I had never experienced before. What it does is that it gave me the tools so that I could save myself.
Yeah.
It didn't save me. It's right. Not magic that way. It doesn't heal alcoholism. It doesn't heal anything. But it gives you the tools and the insight and the self-awareness to be able to tolerate the hard shit, and believe that it could change.
That was one thing that I really learned and I've taken away from you is the awareness piece. This word keeps coming up not only now, but since I went through training. Like you told us in that training that once you're aware of your stories, and I believe you told us we typically have like five life stories that we just kind of continue to repeat. And until we are aware of them, we can't fix them because you don't even know that it's there. It's just something that's, you know, your life. You say, this is my life. It's just what happens or whatever. So that's very interesting to hear that again and to hear it in a different way, because, you know, I think everybody's life stories are different, but they're connected too.
And that reality that we have patterns, we all have patterns, and they actually, as diverse as they seem in our head and every day seems different, there are these five or six patterns that really determine who you're dating and how you react when money comes up. And how you react when you're scared, and what kinds of things you tend to kind of put front. Like, I'm good enough because, like, we all have those stories. And I think that yoga is often kind of advertised or sold as being this this blissy, zenny, happy freedom and feel your power and find your grace and step into your truth and all of that sort of stuff. And that is true. But what you don't necessarily hear is that the way you get to that is by acknowledging your ignorance. Mm. As much as, like, awareness is a good word, but awareness means that you see where you were ignorant before. It directly points out the, hey, you've been doing this shit to yourself over and over and over again. Or there is just so much that you didn't know. You thought you knew, but you don't. So really, I think that the transformational spark that is yoga is realizing where we were ignorant, which can be so destabilizing and terrifying. It's hard to admit that you didn't, that you're ignorant. Like, the word ignorance is important, I think.
It's a harsh word, I think.
It's a harsh word. Mm-hmm. But I think I know that you went through it in your teacher training. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people do. After you get a little bit of yoga in you, there's kind of a breakdown that happens. And it literally is a seeing for the first time of, like, I have been operating on a faulty manual. Mm-hmm. I have been operating on a pattern that is harmful and limiting, and I need to let go of the very things that I've been using as crutches.
Totally. I do want to mention that I have this gut feeling, obviously your training is the only training that I've ever gone through, but I feel like your training is significantly different than trainings you would find at, like, you know, those box yoga studios really. Is that, would you agree with that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I mean, there are certain standards that I need to meet.
Of course.
It needs to have so many hours of this and so many hours of that. And so you need to have kind of a very bare bones curriculum where, you know, you're kind of checking off of the boxes. So theoretically, every teacher training should cover those basic things. But I agree with you that my training is different. I was talking with my teacher yesterday, Leslie Kamenov, and another woman. And we were talking about teacher trainings and quality of them and how generally it's not very good. But we were talking about, like, how can we raise the quality of teacher trainings? And the other woman was saying that she kind of measures it based on the teachers that come out.
Mm.
Right? Like, how good are the teachers that come out? And I wouldn't be satisfied if I just turn out 10 really good yoga instructors a year. That wouldn't make me happy. First of all, I don't know that that actually works, because the quality of those people's teaching is them. It's not necessarily anything I gave them. And I could give great teacher training and still somebody could not take it. So to measure somebody else's, or to put my success contingent on how they're performing, that doesn't make sense to me. But more importantly, I don't care if I'm turning out a bunch of good fitness instructors. What I care about, my metrics for a good teacher training, are the people who went through had an amazing learning experience. That is my value. And I think that I'm able to kind of hone on, and just because I do hone in on, like, it's not about that, it's about you. And when you start to look at you, there is some breaking down that needs to happen, but we also start to see everything differently.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you leave, you tend to be a lot more on fire.
Totally. I can definitely speak to that, in the sense that when I was working, you know, with you in those 5 weeks or 4 weeks, I went in with this expectation, and my expectation was you were going to teach me how to teach a yoga class, and that's not what happened. And but what happened, I have a horseshit memory. I just, I always have. My kids are always like, oh my gosh, mom, you can't remember anything. I'm like, I know. But I remember so much from that training. You brought it down to the level of the history of yoga. And it's to the point where I can regurgitate that. And I'm typically not good at that kind of thing. You know, I'm like, oh, they said it so beautifully and I can't remember, but for that I can. And then how you allowed us to really have the time to, you kind of drop a little something on us and then, you know, we would journal about it, you know, and then I would think about that. I mean, I remember there was one day after our day and I went and walked around Munsinger and I was listening to, I think I was listening to Michael Stone, actually, one of his podcasts, because he came up a lot. I know he was pretty significant in your teachings too. And it just, everything just kind of, you know, when all the dots connect, that's what was happening. And I felt, you can just feel this growth. And then, you know, I kind of walked away like, that was not at all what I expected. Yeah. It was so much more. And it was exactly what I needed that I didn't know I needed. So yeah, so true.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that ideally that's what yoga does. It's not trying to make you into a yoga Barbie or make you do the same pose as all of the other people in the room. But it ideally meets you exactly right where you are. Like you were saying earlier, like it seems to be saying exactly what I needed to hear. It's a pretty phenomenal practice in that way.
It is. And I remember telling you that one time and you said to me, I just speak about what I'm going through, like what I needed to hear. And I'm learning, you know, just in the last, especially 2 years, that so many other people do that. And then it allows us to see like, we're not alone in whatever it is that we're dealing with. And so to know that whether you know that person personally on a, you know, you see them on a regular basis or not, it just feels good. Not that you want someone to be in misery with you or in pain with you, but if it helps you to hear what, you know, their action plan or, you know, just different steps that they're taking to help the process so that they can move past and heal. And then, you know, I actually was just talking to someone a couple weeks ago and they said that same thing. It wasn't related to yoga. It was something else. I'm forgetting what it was, but my memory, but it always brings me back to your class and that, and you saying that, it's like, yes, we're all in this together, big or small. And it's really a beautiful thing, I think, to see it. Mm-hmm. But not everybody sees it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's important. Often when I'm walking around in life, or I'm asked to teach, or I'm asked to speak, you know, I'm brought in as a yoga teacher at this point. Like that's, you know, you brought me on because I'm your yoga teacher. Mm-hmm. But I'm feeling so often that, it's important for me to say that every time I teach, I question whether or not I should be teaching. Every time, every single time. And yes, I do imply the, like, am I able to do this? Am I good enough to do it? Like that is there, and the fear and like all of that is there. But more than that, I question whether or not I should be teaching because there's such a history of cultural appropriation and stealing the narrative from Indian voices, and now it's gym yoga, and it's a white skinny woman who's teaching these ancient things. And so I'm always kind of, there's something that doesn't feel quite right about that, unless I just say, I'm not exactly the best person to teach this to you. But we can have a conversation, and just my acknowledging that that is part of the story and part of my story and part of what's happening in a yoga classroom makes it work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Letting go of the ego is really hard. And I think the quote unquote gym yoga, I think that that's really prevalent. The ego is very loud. And I, you know, when you hear, I remember like when you talk about judgment and when you were in that class and just looking around the room and judging others, there were multiple classes that you would say, don't worry about what your neighbor is doing. Don't watch them. Just listen to what's going on inside your own body and feel what you're feeling. And that would hit me. It was kind of like a little slap across the face, which is why I think I love you so much, is because you can shine light on that. Like, I know what you're thinking because I've done that, you know, and I've been there, but here's what's important. And it is important to look at your own self. And you know what? Today I can't do plank or because my wrist hurts, I have to go on my knees and everybody else in the class is not. Or you know what? I am going to go in child's pose right now because we did two chaturangas and I'm just feeling wiped. And that's okay. And you were always so good about doing that. But there were some times I do remember it was like, damn, she's good. She knows.
Well, you know, I think that you just kind of hit on something in saying, you know, gym yoga doesn't necessarily feel like that. But I think a lot of studio yoga feels like that at this point. The yoga industry has grown so much. It's so big. There are so many yoga studios. And as a part of that happening, they've all kind of become gym yoga. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's been quantity over quality very, very much. Mm-hmm. And the moment it became about, I want to open a business, I want to sell this, if someone is trying to sell you something in yoga or wellness or gyms or diet or all of those related industries, then they're not really taking your best interest to heart. Mm-hmm. They want you to need to buy another package or right. keep coming back. They want you to buy into the next level of thing. Like there is a relationship between the moment it becomes, I'm going to sell you something, and it is not really about the people who are in the room. It's about selling. Mm-hmm. And that by its very nature is harmful to the students because it's not in your best interest. It's just trying to sell you the next thing. The next class, or you need to keep coming, or just the idea that if you do it for 30 days, then this will happen. Mm-hmm. If you keep practicing, then you will get headstand. And it just is kind of this constant aspirational sell of you'll feel better when you mm-hmm. lose the weight, when you're able to do this pose. But there's not a whole lot of truth in that. It's just a selling narrative.
Yep.
It's just to kind of keep you going. And what isn't drawn out in that is that it is directly playing into your self-loathing. It's mm-hmm. directly playing into your ego mm-hmm. rather than giving you some respite from like, I don't have to be that way. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to perform. I can take the time that I need. Like, it's not telling you that. Even if it's the most restorative yoga class ever and it is like, lay back and let it all go. Like the cell is still the same. Mm-hmm. That it is laying low self-esteem on you with like a bucket. and in doing that, it's just underscoring the problems that women in our society, like the reason they went there was because they were hurting in some way, because they didn't like their body, or they were in physical pain, or they were in emotional pain. That's why people go. Everybody, every single person who walks into yoga came for some kind of suffering. And what generally the industry does is just pours gasoline on it. Mm. And makes us stuck in kind of a hamster wheel, and it re-emphasizes your ego and your aloneness, and it doesn't necessarily help you understand like the bigger picture. And that, you know what, even if you did lose 20 pounds, you might not be happy yet. Like you're still going to be you. How many times has that story played out in people's lives? Or like you get the job and you're still miserable.
Yep.
Or whatever, like that sell is a lie.
Yeah.
And it's tough because I think that it is so everywhere and we're so used to it. I mean, we grew up with it.
Yep.
That's how we were raised.
Yeah.
As women in particular, we're raised to be perfect or be so quiet that nobody notices. And be good and to like follow along. Like that's what we're taught. And all of these industries are feeding directly into body image issues and competitive issues. And they're like, if you just keep buying more, then all your problems will go away without actually addressing real problems.
So what
I don't
do
know
we do?
How I went on that line. Oh, what do we do? I think that...
I mean, I feel like there is healing in yoga if you can find the teacher. Like when I found you, you showed me that it's not, and you kept you've mentioned that so many times. You would always say it's not about the pose.
Yeah, it's not.
It's about you.
I do think that like it works. There's something to being in your body that will work, even if it is the most, like I said, I started in Bikram, which isn't really a thing anymore. But it's the hot 26 poses over and over. And again, they don't teach any philosophy. It's just do this very physical instruction. But even that worked. And I tell people all the time when they like move or they're looking and like find a core power, they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Because even the worst yoga probably will still work. And honestly, I think that that is true of running and hiking and dancing and for women weightlifting. Like, I think that there is something to being in your own body that does start to shake things up and challenge your ignorance. And it's empowering, basically. And I think if you really let that process happen, the bigger questions start to fall into place too, which is, I love it when I see somebody kind of go through a cycle where they fall in love with the thing, whatever it is, whether it's CrossFit or yoga or blah, 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 blah. But they go through this process. And at the end of 2 years of having gone through massive overhaul of their life, generally it's like huge divorce and then a job, like it's a big resettling of everything in their life. And at the end of it, they realize that they don't need the CrossFit anymore or the yoga. I will get emails and things from people who I haven't seen in 7 years because they haven't been, they're not doing yoga anymore, or they're just not around my orbit anymore. But I'll get an email that says, I was going through a really dark place in my life and yoga and your teaching, like they were central to, and now I'm like, they're off in some other thing that maybe probably has nothing to do with yoga, but they have been able to go to a better place in their life because they went through the yoga thing.
So we have to have a breakdown to rebuild.
Yes.
I'm noticing that you like everything kind of has to crumble around you and you think you're, you know, the sky is falling, your world's falling apart and it's never going to be the same, but I think good. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be the same, you know? Yeah. I love that message. That's really powerful, but it's really hard in those moments when you are going through the breakdown and having those breakthroughs.
Yep. Absolutely.
Really fucking hard.
Absolutely. And again, I don't think, you know, it doesn't just happen to one person. I think it happens to people, everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that like that's what's happening to us as a community right now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
Can we talk
going,
about that?
Absolutely. We are going through this incredible phase of being able to see where we've been ignorant, right? Mm-hmm. And being able to see how systemic anti-blackness in particular as being like, that's distinct from racism, like just this historical legacy of slavery and genocide of the Native peoples, like that is so ingrained in our culture that most white people can't see it. That's how ingrained it is. Mm-hmm. But I think that we are at a moment where all of the sudden people are like, oh my God, I see. Oh my, and they're struggling with that, and there's so much pain, and I think it's important to point out, first of all, that the pain that white people are feeling right now is definitely traumatic, but it is not the same thing that Black people live through every day. And I just, it's so pervasive that it's in our wellness worlds too. I mean, how many times have you been in a yoga class where there is a body of color? And again, there's kind of this like smack in the face irony in that it comes from people of color. I actually, when I talk with South Asian women about yoga practices, they generally say, I will never go to a yoga studio because it is so offensive and so uncomfortable. And the things that are said there and the things that are taught there are generally so wrong that I won't go. And to be honest, like even as a yoga teacher, I don't go to yoga classes because they tend to be pretty bad in terms of that, like, who is welcome here? Is this a safe space? No. The last yoga class I went to, this is terrible. You're listening to like poppy, flowy music the whole way through, which I don't like. But that's, you know, that's me. So I was like, okay, whatever. And it was clearly somebody who had been trained at Core Power because they have a certain sequence that they go through. And I'm like, okay, this is terrible in my body at this point because I'm, you know. But okay, I'll make my little adjustments and we'll go on. So we get through the class and eventually we lay down in Shavasana and the bad music starts to fade out. And I'm like, oh my God, thank God, I can finally get my Shavasana. And as the bad music starts to fade out, she starts to play some Lakota drumming and chanting without acknowledging at all that we are actually practicing on occupied Lakota territory. Like, she did not in any way give acknowledgement to the land or the history or anything. She was just playing it because it's what, mystical? I don't know. And then, so then I'm uncomfortable in that way and like, oh, this is kind of weird. And what does that have to do with yoga? And it's just like, I was kind of crawling in my skin. And then she lit some sage. And then she was walking around with a turkey feather and like smudging us all with it. Again, with no cultural conversation about what that was. And then she had us finally roll up and sit up. And she talked about the importance of loving ourselves. And that maybe what we need to focus on is more loving ourselves. And while I understand that need, I also think that teaching people over and over and over again that what they need to do is be more self-centered is really harmful.
Right.
That was the last yoga class I went to. I was like, no, I'm done. I'm not participating in this culture anymore. There's these traditions that white women in particular are taking up as being so empowering and so liberating. And this is true even of like Zumba is another really good example where they're taking black music and black dance moves. And again, it's usually a bunch of white women who are practicing it, and it is empowering. And they're sold this like, you own your body and you're beautiful just the way you are. And we're just sold these ideas, but we're practicing using the techniques and the technology and the culture of a people who are not there and are literally not welcome there. It may not be explicit, but they are not there because they're not comfortable. And there's an understanding about the systemic racism and that if you are not being explicitly anti-racist, then you will end up being unintentionally racist. So we have a whole bunch of unintentional racism happening in the diet industry, in the yoga, and like in all of these industries that we so need. They have been so corrupted and taken away literally from their sources. And now they're just used to sell white women more shame. Mm-hmm. And if you think about what shame does, this is the really fucked up part. What shame does is it shuts you up. Mm. And again, like that's what we've been taught. Yeah. That is the systemic thing that we have been taught, is that unless you can perform perfectly and get a star, be so silent that no one will even notice you're there. As soon as a white woman feels any amount of shame, she falls back into silence. And part of that is literal nervous system stuff. Your nervous system goes into fight, flight, freeze, freeze, freeze. So we are freezing ourselves with this huge amount of shame, which then, you know, our privileged position is part of that bigger systemic thing. So we're being fed shame and like told to self-improve ourselves endlessly. And that very like treadmill that we're on is reinforcing neighborhoods and money and all of these very systemic ways in which Black people in particular are given the lowest possible opportunity.
Yeah.
Or acknowledgement or fucking right to breathe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It is really hard. And you know what I think we need to just be having these conversations.
100%.
This is another way where when you reached out to me, my first reaction was, oh hell no, not right now. Because of everything that is happening in the world, I think that it is so important that we white women, rather than talk about our feelings and our self-development, which is what we do all the fucking time, mm-hmm. white women need to be able to just sit back and listen. So when you reached out, I was like, oh, no, 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 no. Or maybe I will give her the name of someone else who is a Black woman of color who could talk about her experience. But then eventually I was like, no, I think that I can come on because white women need to talk to white women about our own racism.
Yes.
So
I agree
that like it's going to be imperfect and our emotions are going to come up and our shame is going to come up, but we have to heal our own shame.
Totally. You know, I've been sitting with all of this, I am a white woman and I do have privilege, and it's interesting, you know, women haven't always had privilege, but being in a position where I do, and I unfortunately have never seen it that way. You know, we get, like you were saying, we get so wrapped up. Yep. And we're wrapped up in our lives and our own minds and the self-centeredness, exactly like what you were speaking about. I listened to a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and it was this, and this is the thing, and I want to just say this because I don't even know what is PC anymore. Can I say black? What do you say? Do you say African American? I don't know. And that's the truth. And I want to know. I want to know all the things. But I was listening to a Black woman speak about what's happening in the world. And she said, I'm not going to sit here and tell you what to do. You have to figure that out for yourself. But the only piece of advice that I can offer anyone and everyone is look in your circle. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a very small, rural Minnesota town, and there was so much racism. And mm-hmm. I think maybe one Black person was at my school, maybe. And she said, start with your family and your friends and start speaking up. And I'm looking back now and I'm thinking about that. Like, I remember, you know, racist jokes that would happen on the everyday occasion. Mm-hmm. And because the people that it was coming from, I just wanted their love.
Absolutely.
You laugh at the jokes, but in my gut, I intuitively knew it didn't feel right, but I didn't know any different, right? That's how I was raised.
Right.
And so I look at this now and like you were saying, you sit back and you be quiet because yes, shame and guilt, and you're a woman, so you are seen and not heard. I now have found my fucking voice. And I know that if I heard something like that from the person that I thought I wanted the love from, I am strong enough now. And a huge part of that is because I've been able to find myself through yoga, and I can find my strength through that and its teachings and being in my body. And there is something to be said for that, right?
Absolutely.
But now I know I would have the power and the strength to say that and just, I don't agree with that. I don't think that's okay. And if they wanted to come back, they can. That's their, but that's them. That's on their shoulders, you know. And I'm part Native American, and I've always been drawn to their culture. I did not grow up with the culture, but I have always felt this like innate feeling that I want the practices of the Native culture, and I am sickened. Like right now, we're traveling and. For my husband's work, and we were down in the San Luis Valley, which is in the southeast part of Colorado. Mm-hmm. And the San Luis Valley, I was talking to this woman down there, and she said, this is where the natives would have their peace gatherings. They would never allow war or fighting in the valley. They would maybe come and they would have their ceremonies, of course, but and they would maybe speak about when to have a war or whatever, but nothing would ever happen on the valley floor. And there is something so spiritual about that space, just being in, I felt it. And it was like, I could feel, you know, and then I could feel the culture down there. It's very present. And then I've always thought, you know, God, as a white person, I'm mad that I have any white, like I wish that I was 100% Native. I really do, because I want to know about their ways. I want to learn all the things. I wish I could find a medicine man. I wish I could find, someone.
When you can. And I want to push back on that a little bit and say that if you were 100% Native, that you would have gone through a lot of trauma at this point in your life, right? Like, it is easy to, I think that that's like a next stage on understanding the systemic nature of racism, and whiteness is almost this revulsion of our whiteness. And like, I don't want to be like those racist people. I don't want to be like that. Mm-hmm. And I wish that I had some access and memory of these more holistic cultures and understandings. And I think that the longing for the holistic ceremonies and medicine that you've talked about, I think that that is entirely valid. And I think that we can find, those things are still there. These people are still alive. But it is really hard within our little white bubbles to even know where and how and how does one begin that process. But I think it does begin with just kind of looking, being able to sit with your own comfort, and rather than just like make yourself feel better right away, just be able to sit with how painful it is. And then start to look for resources, because these people are here. They're not gone.
Do I put an ad out on Craigslist in search of?
Just keep Googling. And, you know, this actually has been pretty high on my thoughts recently in the last couple of weeks. One of the statistics I saw, I think it is coming out of D'Angelo's book, White Fragility, or in the research that she did to write that book, because she like looked for data. She was like, what are the actual numbers on who lives where? Who graduates from high school? What does it mean to live in this part of the world or that part of the world? What are the actual like numbers on this stuff? How do we measure it? And they're terrifying to look at and deeply shameful to look at. But one of them that stuck in my craw was the idea, or not the idea, the number that only 1 in 8 white people have a black friend. Not somebody at work or somebody you like run into at the gym. Like you might know a black, but like a black friend.
Right.
1 in 8 white people.
Hmm.
By comparison, every black person has at least 12 white people within their immediate circle. We do not know how to have relationships and friendships with people of other colors. We don't know how to be in those relationships. And again, we were taught this, and we were taught like they don't exist anymore. It's, you have to go to like a sacred desert somewhere to find it. Or, you know, there's pieces of black culture that we can get, but if you go into the wrong neighborhood, you're going to get hurt because it's dangerous down there. Like we are taught these things instead of taught how to actually be in relationship with actual human beings. So I think one of the most powerful things we can start to look at individually is like, yes, do your research, use Google, start to read your stuff, and do start to push back, maybe on family, maybe on job, maybe on all those other things. But really, it comes down to a question of can you be in relationship? And I think that that is going to require some actual soul searching for many of us. Like, how do I do that?
Yeah.
It's entirely possible. So let's not get stuck in the how do I do that? I don't know anybody. But can you sit with that soul searching, like, why don't I, what, where do I hang out that I'm not coming in contact with any black people?
Yeah.
Where am I buying my food that I'm not coming in contact? What books am I reading? How do I socialize? And this is true even if you're a fucking introvert. But just starting to examine, you're like, what am I doing that is keeping me in the white bubble?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I disinvest myself from that so that I can actually start to meet people and not like go up to somebody and be like, hi, will you be my black friend? Because there's enough of that shit. And now in the last couple of weeks, like every black person I know is exhausted because all the white people are coming up to them and doing that. Mm-hmm. They're all, my husband, was a hall monitor in a high school last year. And he and I think 5 or 6 other black men in a vastly black and Hmong high school. So it's like 2% white or something. Most of the teachers are white. All of the higher administration is white, but the hall monitors are all black. And they had to go back in last week as kids were picking up cap and gowns. So they haven't been there for months and, you know, but they were there. But now all of this rebellion has started happening. And the hall monitors were hanging out. And at one point, Gunnar says, one of them kind of leaned forward and looked around and was like, is anybody listening? Are any of those white people listening? And then like, if another fucking one of those white teachers comes up to me and tells me that she sees me and she hears me and she feels me, I'm going to fucking, like, just... how, like, we can't do that. Like, that's not helpful, but we can start to live different lives in little tiny, tiny, tiny ways. But it's going to be hard.
Let it develop organically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of uncomfort.
I so love that you're bringing that up because, you know, for me, Isaac and I talked about this, like, when, you know, we're in the camper and we're kind of just, you know, we're on the western slope, we're just popping around, you know, the boys and I are just like basically following him around for work. We don't often have Wi-Fi. So, you know, and the cell service is shit everywhere we go over there for whatever reason or another. And so I feel really disconnected. And we started talking about how, you know, I feel disconnected. And I talked about this in episode 11 with him, but I don't know what to do. I don't know what part I can play. And I think that this is a start.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's necessary. And a part of me initially to what you're saying is I just wanted to keep it that way.
Mm.
You know, like I just wanted to just be in my little bubble and just, okay, I know I know what I know and I'm safe, but I know that that's not in tune with who I am at my core.
Right. Right.
I'm braver.
It's not like we can break down. We really can.
Yep.
And we know that in some ways, those of us who've had some yoga training or whatever, that is kind of that similar, like, you know, from previous experiences that you can do hard things.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to recognize that this is asking us to do hard things. It's not asking you to be nicey-nice and like do lots of, it's not asking for anything in particular, because there's no one right way to unlearn, but we have to look at our own ignorance.
Totally.
So, you know, depending on where you live and depending on how old you are and are you an introvert or are you an extrovert, like there's not a right way necessarily, other than just this acknowledging that we need to physically and intellectually and heartfully actually accept that, like, I've got to do some work.
Yep. That's hard.
It really is. And I think that we all do. Like there's not a single white person who can.
Yeah.
But there are so many, there are so many ways in, and because this history that we have inherited is so systemic that it has ramifications everywhere. It has ramifications in music. It has ramifications in food. It has ramifications in children and like education. And it has ramifications in the wellness world, in the yoga world. It has ramifications in gardening. It has ramifications even in like public parks and hiking and biking, because we know that there are black birders, because white women will sometimes call the police on, like, there you can find the system and how it is played out and like what is the reality you're seeing in whatever you're already interested in. So if you love food, start to get interested in food and like the politics or even just the culture of food. Because that a lot of what we consider to be like Southern cooking is black cooking, but we call it Southern cooking, not black cooking. But just starting to get interested in like, where does food come from? So it doesn't need to be an overtly political act all the time. Mm-hmm. I think that's exhausting and unreal.
Right.
But if you're really interested in painting, you can look at how that has showed up in painting. And like, what is your community of art? Because it's in that world too. It's in, and so whatever a person's like personal literature, you can look at literature and how has the black voice been suppressed? How has it expressed itself anyway? How has that played? So like, no matter what it is that you love, I mean, you could probably find it in astrology if you wanted to. In fact, I know you could, because there is a long history of healing circles and using astrology within the black feminist community, actually. Like, you can find relationship and history and change just by making a commitment to go closer to the things you already love.
Mm.
You do not need to like be active in politics. You don't have to read all the books, because some of us are not readers. You don't always have to confront your grandpa, because that could just be like beating your head against a wall, honestly.
Yep.
But you can go closer to what you love.
Yeah. I really love that message. And I never thought about it like that.
It's everywhere. It like that, this, I'm sharing this because this has been like a personal practice of mine in looking and seeing like, well, how has it showed up in music and how has it showed up in theater? And now we're starting to see every industry, like publishing and theater is the one I'm thinking of because I know some theater people, but like the industry is all of a sudden being self-reflective and being able to show over and over and over again how anti-blackness has shown up. So if we just go closer to those things and actually make commitments there, I think that we'll quickly be able to activate and heal. Because ultimately, that's what it is. It's a healing.
Yeah. For everyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not that, like, me needing to work through my white privilege and my innate racism, because it's there. I have been taught it from the time I was an infant. It's not that working through that shit is going to, like, lessen the goodness of life for me. It's going to make it better, because I'm not going to have so much shame and, like, all of my, those patterns. My life will be bigger and sweeter. And
we all play a part.
Absolutely.
Yep. We all have a role to play and we all have a voice, and it's just a matter of finding it in our own way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to be able to recognize that because it is everywhere, in every different system, at every different level, it's important that we do make some kind of, like, commitment to changing those structures. And so, like, if you're in education, you need to start calling educational systems to task. If you're in business or banking or whatever, like, we do need to do some structural change, because racism is structural. But there's a difference between making structural change and systemic change and making our own kind of behavioral and feeling and relational change. And that we can kind of, you know, we don't need to go change the world all the time. And we can't. We can't. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that urge to, like, I need to go fix all the things and I need to speak up and I need to repost all the things. We're not listening. We're actually often taking the stage away from somebody else. So we don't need to be doing that all of the time. A lot of it is the more tender heart work that involves, like, journaling and conversations and friendships. And how sacred friendships are. But it doesn't have to be one. There is no one white, right way. Mm-hmm. I keep saying one white way. Like, blah, blah, blah.
I mean, equally the same, right?
Absolutely. But I think that there, again, culturally, we are thrown all of this should. You should, you should, you should. Like, right? Like, that's how we're raised. And then we go into either way over performativeness, or we start shutting down and, like, I don't know where to begin and it hurts too much and I'm scared. And so, it's not should. There is no should. There's just do. Maybe one day it'll be this and the next day it'll be that. But, you know, I was talking actually with some Black yoga teachers yesterday about diversifying the yoga industry. And she was bringing up some beautiful statistics in saying that Generation Z, which is actually, I think, even younger than your kids, mm-hmm. right? Like it's the kids that are in grade school right now.
Yep.
They are 50% mixed race.
Wow.
Right? Like, so, and when they are the adults of the world, it's going to be a different world. This fight is going to be won. It's probably not going to be won this year. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be won in a week. It's just not. As empowering and magical and terrifying as events can be, because a single event can just, like, break your heart. It's not, the one piece is not the whole. Yeah. I've been trying to focus my own heart on, like, how do I commit to this for the long haul, for the next, you know, years, and my nieces mm-hmm. and kids, so that I'm not just super active and vocal now, but that
in a few years, I have better relationships. In a few years, I know more. Because that's how we learn. That's how we change. It's just that slow drip of, and it's going to be imperfect and it's going to be messy and we're going to screw up and say the wrong things, but we have to have the conversations.
I love that you're giving, you do this in yoga too, but I love that you're giving us permission to fuck up.
Absolutely. Because we have to. We have to, if we, because that's the, like, the, don't shame. Don't shame. It's so tough. It's hard.
Mm-hmm. And that's why for me, I think initially I was like, I just backed away. Like I can't do anything because I'm going to, you know, I'm this white woman of privilege. If I say something, I'm going to say the wrong thing. If I don't do anything, I'm doing the wrong thing. But now I've just realized that through, you know, what I've learned over, I mean, the growth that I've learned over the last 6 years has, it's immense. It's huge. Mm. The biggest growth I've ever seen in my whole life. That now I recognize that you fail forward.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Exactly.
You have to fail forward because you can't have someone tell you what to do. Because that might work for them.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Like you actually need to move into that space, your physical self. And that process doesn't happen without there being mistakes. And you have to leave where you are. You have to leave your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And if you leave your comfort zone, it's going to be terrifying. And because it's terrifying, you are going to say really stupid shit sometimes.
Yep.
Yeah, last night I was actually journaling and I was realizing that like the practice of apologizing might be a really good practice for me right now.
Mm.
Again, because culturally and just kind of within my family, the ability to say you're sorry and mean it and then try to change behavior, that's not a skill we were taught. At all. Like you either wouldn't say it, you would just move on, or you'd say it in some kind of like, oh, I'm sorry. But there was never that, like, I acknowledge that I messed up. I'm sorry. And I'm going to change my behavior. I don't know how to do that very well. And I don't think most white people do. I think that again is right back into that shame place of having to admit that you were wrong and you maybe stepped on somebody's toes or you, that is not a comfort place for us. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I need to practice apologizing and get really good at it. Because if I'm okay apologizing to my husband and my sister or my yoga students, or like, I need to have that skill. Because that's what's being asked of us again, is like communication and relationships. So I'm going to practice apologizing.
That is so interesting, because lately I've been practicing not apologizing.
Well, but that's another piece of the cultural puzzle, right? Where women are just like, oh, sorry, sorry, sorry.
I'm in the
where
way.
Where we didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
Like, we're not sorry. That's another piece of the puzzle. But like, legitimately being able to apologize when we've done something wrong. To not over-apologize
mm-hmm.
for stuff that we don't need to. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of the same practice.
Totally. Yeah.
But it's kind of phenomenal that we both honed in on like, huh, that's a problem. It is. And that's how deeply ingrained some of this stuff is that we just don't know how to have good communication, good relationships.
Yep. Yeah. Always a work in progress, life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it really comes down to if people are willing to do the hard work.
Yeah.
You know, it is easy sometimes. I think initially it's easy to take the easy way out, but it comes back oftentimes tenfold and it bites you in the ass and you're like, yeah. Oh, I should have just dealt with that.
Yeah, exactly. 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 I had a teacher that used to talk about that and he was like, you know what? It's okay if you screw up now. The lesson will come back. It'll come back. So having a little bit of, like, it's okay to be as imperfect and as messy and as confused as we are and as ignorant as we are.
You know, we were taught this. It was in our small towns, in our schools. It was literally the history we were taught was very not fair.
No.
So we were taught this.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to actually now learn something different. And we can.
Yep. We're all very capable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. That's really big stuff. But I appreciate, like, you know, like I said at the beginning, just to kind of bring this back full circle, you always offer a space, I feel, where people can feel, I know it's so true for me, that I can be raw and I can be authentic, and you don't push me away. You help, you hold, you support, and you offer perspectives that otherwise I wouldn't have seen. And I think that that's true for a lot of people that have worked with you. I know that that is true for sure. Yeah. So what are you up to these days? Can people work with you? Can people, what's that like? And what are some resources that maybe we can give our listeners?
Yeah. Thank you for that opportunity. That's great. I'm actually kind of more accessible than ever because most of my stuff is online because we can't teach yoga right now.
Right.
I actually am really enjoying that space because I'm able to connect interestedly in a really intimate way with people because I'm kind of doing mentor kind of ship conversations and mentoring kind of study programs where like we're reading this book. So my yoga teacher training, I've even kind of taken it farther and farther away from like, here's what you need to know to lead a fitness class. Cause I'm like, you can go to 5 and you'll know how to do it. That's how you learn how to do it. Like go to 5 classes, you'll know what it is, but let's talk about our hearts. Let's talk. So my teacher training at this point is an online experience and we have a group of people and we meet on Zoom, but then I also literally mentor people so that once a month I'm talking with just them and talking about that, like, what questions do you have? What do you want to learn? But also then it ends up being like a deeply personal, like it's just an ongoing process. So returnyoga.org, you can find all the things.
Yay. I will definitely add that in the show notes because as I know, and as I'm sure others are gathering just from this conversation, that you're going to grow and you're going to learn and it's going to be powerful and it's going to be impactful.
Absolutely. And I've taught it for many years in a row and every year it's different because of the people who come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the same conversation, if you put different people in it, it will be a different conversation. But I also feel like I've gotten a lot better at it and I've really honed in on like, this is what it is important to me to get across. And it is, I want a person to have an amazing experience. And I think that I talk about social justice and feminism and like, you know, shame and how these things play out. Like they're showing up when we are in the gym. They're showing up when you're raising your kids. They're showing up in school classrooms and they are absolutely showing up in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So like, let's talk about those things. So I like to think that my training in particular is much more a kind of journey of self-discovery and seeing how all these threads tie together.
Totally. So yes. Yes, it does. Do you offer supplemental classes? Like I know.
Yeah, I'm kind of always playing with how I do it, but I record a weekly kind of meditation sort of, but it usually has a little bit of movement and breath.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes a visualization or something so that it's just enough movement to get you in your body.
Yep.
And to start to notice your breathing because it's usually whatever it usually is for you. So it's just enough of that that you can physiologically shift gears and then you can meditate. Because we all know that like you're like, I'm going to meditate now, tends to not work.
Not work, yep.
And those are just half an hour little things. And I try to make them like, you don't need a mat. You don't need to put on yoga clothes. You can do them in your street clothes, or you can do them in your office at work, over your lunch break if you wanted to. So fully adaptive and accessible, I hope. Yeah. And for $10 a month, you can get those.
Yeah.
They're on Patreon.
Okay. And I've done a few of those, and it's exactly that. You do, you find your body, and then you can sink into your brain and your mind and your heart too.
Yep. And I like to offer that because there are so many people who are like, I'm interested, but I can't touch my toes. Right? Like, how often have you heard, I've heard meditation's good for me. I've heard yoga's good for me, but, and really, I just want to cut to the heart of, like, forget all the flexibility stuff. Forget all of that fancy stuff. All you need is a few minutes.
Yep.
And a body.
Yep. Are you still doing, I know a number of years ago I took an Ayurvedic?
That is actually, yep.
Okay. Do you still?
Did you do the art of self-care that is like 2.5 months long, or did you do a shorter thing?
It was just like an afternoon, so we just probably touched the surface.
Oh my gosh, I have a 2.5 month thing.
Ooh, I think I need to get in on that, actually.
Yeah, it's called The Art of Self-Care.
Okay.
It is a 2.5 month thing where I made these videos. This year was the fifth year we went through, so I do it every January because of, you know, the New Year's resolution thing. But it's kind of anti-resolution in that everything I do is kind of like, no, you don't need another top 10 list because you know it didn't work. It didn't work last year. It didn't work the year before. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of trying to say, what is it about yoga that actually works? What is it about, like, Ayurveda is the diet, medicine, kind of the naturopathy, like nature is healing. Mm-hmm. And if we eat natural things and at the right time, our body will know what to do with it. So traditionally yoga and Ayurveda were taught together. Like, you wouldn't be doing yoga poses unless you were also doing Ayurveda, and vice versa. Like, you wouldn't be looking at these herbal remedies and those kinds of practices, but you'd also be doing some kind of yoga. So Ayurveda is the diet and medicine, but usually if you like Google stuff, it sounds like some rare herb that has to come from somewhere in Asia and can only be harvested on like a full moon at a certain time of the year.
Yep.
And it turns into, again, like the food rules. It turns into the food rules. Mm. That's not really how it works. Just like that's not how yoga works. So I had, for 10 weeks, I have one, like, try this week. Mm. And then the next week, I'm like, try this week. And you eventually get the 10 that are kind of like, this is the principle. And it is beautiful. Every year, I'm like, I should re-record it. It's 5 years old. But every year, man, people have gone through such powerful changes personally. And people have come out being like, I have been teaching yoga for 15 years. I've never learned as much as I just learned in the last 2 months. I learned more than teacher trainings anyway. And people have found their IBS goes away. One woman lost 70 pounds without trying to. People who have anxiety are seeing their anxiety go. And it's so gentle. Yeah. It's just kind of like, understand what a body is. Understand what food is, do the right things at the right time, and you feel better. But we feel so different. It's like that first time where I woke up in the middle of the night and was like, what is this body? Is this my body? It's yeah. so different that people end up having this transformative, like, I didn't know how alive I was.
Mm. Yeah.
I didn't believe that I could feel different. Because I was so used to just feeling tired all the time or bloated all the time. Yeah. Or like my period always hurts. We're so used to feeling one way, we don't realize it's possible to feel a different way. So that happens every January.
Do you break
again,
down?
It's all online.
And do you break down like Pitta, Veda? Okay. Because I remember that's just what we touched on. It was just like figuring out kind of what your
constitution.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that elaborates it all then within that 2 month span. Perfect. Yep. Love it.
You will learn a lot of things. Yeah, I would. You would really love it because it's a pre-recorded conversation. And then I also have like an optional, I will be live and we can, if you have questions or that sort of thing. So it's, and that is actually part of the teacher training. I wrapped it in because it is such a gem. It's so, so powerful. So the first in the teacher training, we start in September, and the first couple months, it's kind of looking at history and philosophy and like, here's the overview. And then I do the art of self-care and I'm like, all right, now practice. Now go deep into your body. Go deep into your mind and your life. And like, so then you're really getting the nourishing. And it's right over, you know, January and February, so midwinter. And then after people have had that like deep personal experience of it, then the third piece of it is reading one of the texts. Mm. And the whole time you're getting this one-on-one mentorship with me. So people can either do the art of self-care just independently and join the group for that part, or they can go through the whole thing. The
whole thing. Beautiful.
Or you can just do the weekly meditations with me for $10 a month.
I love it.
Thank you for giving me that opportunity to be like, do this.
No, yes, of course, because you are such an amazing teacher. And like I said, I've learned so much from you. And because I've learned so much from you, I've learned so much about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it all starts.
Yeah, exactly. That is the entire point.
Yep, exactly. Well, thank you, Karen, for being here today. I so very much am grateful for you and your time. And I know that, you know, there's a lot happening. And so I'm really glad that you decided to say yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I am too.
Thank you.
It's all about relationships and you're important to me. Mm. So I was always going to say yes. I might have had some qualms about it, but I was going to say yes because you're important to me.
Oh.
And I know that relationships are important and conversations are important, even when they're awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do we talk about this?
Yep.
Just do.
Yep. Perfect. That's a great way to wrap things up. Well, again, thank you. And I will definitely add all of these links in the show notes because you are such a powerful, impactful teacher and you teach by example. And I think that that's really important. You know, you don't say one thing and do another. You do live all of this and that's huge. So anyway, for our listeners, I will add all of the links in the show notes this week. And with that, thank you for tuning in.
Karen's approach to yoga is so unique. And when you find yourself in conversation with her, it sticks. Her ability to shine light on the shadows of life naturally make you start to think about your own life, where you are, and where you want to go. She is raw living at the core. You can find out more on her website, returnyoga.org. The link is in the show notes. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please subscribe to the show and leave a review while you are there. Every time a review or rating is received, it opens up the platform that allows the show to reach a wider range of listeners. Your support is greatly appreciated. Thank you for tuning in to this week's podcast. Thank you for your time, energy, and presence. I am grateful for you and your motivation to improve your quality of life. Heal yourself, heal the world. It's always an adventure. Adventure awaits.